Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as you do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. And in a few minutes, we should be joined by Jesse Eisinger, who should be joining us here in the studio. He is with the nonprofit journalism organization ProPublica, and he's written a couple of pieces for them on what kind of chicanery went on during the bubble that left Wall Street much worse for wear, and unfortunately the rest of us as well, specifically how all the banks were selling each other CDOs instead of selling it to real customers, equivalent of taking in each other's washing, but for very high fees. So we'll hear what that's all about. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Michael Yates, who is a retired economist who's been traveling around the U.S. for, 5 or 10 years now, and accumulating a lot of observations about the state of things, the physical and political and psychological state of these United States, and not a pretty story. And he has a post in his blog, Cheap Motels and a Hot Plate, about a week ago, detailing a vast mood of passive aggression among the American population. We'll hear from Michael about that. He's had a lot of observations about the devolution of this society. But first, some observations on the economic news. A somewhat better tone to that economic news over the past week. First-time claims for unemployment insurance, reported Thursday morning, fell by 6,000 last week, the second consecutive weekly decline. The level remains very elevated, not the sort of thing you'd like to see in a serious recovery, but at least it's not rising anymore. Also, better news out of the manufacturing sector, as the Institute for Supply Management's monthly survey of purchasing managers, the people who buy things for factories and who are therefore in intimate contact with the state of the business, that survey rose last month. So did its Chinese counterpart, relieving worries that the world's second-largest economy was following the world's largest into a slowdown. There was also a pickup in pending house sales, meaning contracts signed, but deals not yet closed, a rare bit of good news from that depressed sector. But, as I've been saying for a long time, we're facing what could be years of a crappy economy. Further evidence for this case was offered by Carmen Reinhart and Vincent Reinhart in a paper they presented at the Jackson Hole Conference, sponsored by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City at the end of every summer, just a few days ago. Reviewing the evidence going back to the 1929 stock market crash in the U.S. and covering much of the globe since, they find that GDP growth and housing prices in the wake of financial crises and their ensuing recessions, GDP growth and housing prices remain significantly lower in the 10-year window following the crisis when compared with the decade that preceded it. With the exception of the 1973 oil shock, inflation is also lower. So all those anxieties among worry warts about an impending inflation threat are completely unfounded, at least on the basis of this historical evidence. Despite the eagerness of many to withdraw the stimulus coming from the government sometime soon, the Reinhart's work argues against that. In a 2009 paper, they looked at the precedent of the 1930s for guidance for today's policymakers and how to cope with the deflationary, depressionary threat today. Among their discoveries, sustained fiscal stimulus is important. And they say countries that were more consistent in keeping spending high tended to recover more quickly than those that didn't. And wavering, that is, stimulus followed by retrenchment, which is what we may be facing, was quite damaging to recovery prospects. That hasn't stopped bourgeois apologists from making up stories. In a speech delivered a few weeks ago in the remote reaches of the upper peninsula of Michigan, Minneapolis Federal Reserve President Narayana Kochlakota claimed that there's been a major breakdown between the relationship between the unemployment rate and the number of job vacancies reported in the Bureau of Labor Statistics Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, known as JOLTS. Points to this breakdown as a major reason for the unemployment rate remaining so high. According to Kochlakota, the breakdown began in mid-2008 as the unemployment rate rose more rapidly than the JOLTS opening data suggest, a breakdown that intensified in mid-2009 as the unemployment rate continued to rise and then failed to decline significantly as the number of openings rose by nearly 20%. Kochlakota explains this by asserting that there's a mismatch between the skills, geography, and demographics of available workers and unfilled openings. And that's not anything that monetary policy can change. As he says, the Fed does not have the means to transform a construction worker into manufacturing workers. This packs a load of nonsense into a concentrated space. While he's right that the unemployment rate hasn't fallen as much as the JOLTS data suggests it should, there are still almost 5 unemployed workers for every opening, down from over 6 at the end of 2009, but still enormously high. The major problem with the labor market today is and remains that the recession was harsh and the recovery so far has been weak. The gap between GDP growth and employment growth, though wider than it was in the recessions of the early 1990s and early 2000s, isn't at all out of line with earlier downturns like those of the 1950s, mid-1970s, and early 1980s. Since the JOLTS data that Kochler-Koda bases his mismatch thesis on only begins in December 2000, he's missing a lot of important history. In other words, this isn't the mild recession followed by a slow recovery that we had 10 and 20 years ago. It's more like the harsher recessions of earlier decades, only worse. Also, the share of permanent job losers, as opposed to those on temporary layoff, hit a record high in over 40 years of data at the end of 2009, and has come down only slightly since. By contrast, the share on temporary layoff is at a record low. Clearly, this composition of the unemployed makes re-employment a lot harder. In a paper prepared for a Brookings Institution panel last March, Michael Elsby, Bart Hoban, and Ashigal Sahin review the grim pathologies of the labor market in this, the Great Recession. In almost every aspect, the downturn was the worst since the 1930s. Among their specific points, While inflows into unemployment, that is, the number of people becoming freshly unemployed, in the early part of the recession were dominated by the weaker demographics, people who are generally worse off in the job market, the young, the less educated, and the non-white. The rate of exit from unemployment has been broadly similar for all subgroups. That is, it's really not a demographic problem or anything like that. It is a broad, broad economic problem that applies to just about everyone. Since the workforce is now older than it was in earlier recessions, the rise in the unemployment rate is actually sharper than it appears, since older workers are less likely to be disemployed than younger ones. The dominance of long-term unemployment among the jobless in this cycle is disturbing, since the longer people are unemployed, the less likely they are to find new employment. Based on historical relations, Elsby and company project that the decline in unemployment could be half as rapid as it was in the mid-1980s. Of course, if economic growth remains weak as it is, then that recovery would be even slower. Speaking of the job market, a few words on the two listening areas where this station is heard, where this program is heard. Between the onset of recession in December 2007 and the bottom in the national job market 2 years later, December 2009, just over 6% of the jobs in the U.S. disappeared. New York State could fare considerably better, losing less than 4%. Only 8 states and the District of Columbia did better. California, however, ranked 5th in job loss, losing over 9% of its jobs, more than twice as much as New York, and half again as bad as the national average. And in the 6 months ending in June, a time of relative recovery nationally, New York has gained more jobs in percentage terms than the national average, and California has gained less. Overall, the Mountain and Pacific regions have seen the worst job losses over the last few years and the weakest recoveries. The Mountain region was pulled down by the miserable performance of the two major housing bubble and bust states, Arizona and Nevada, and of course Pacific. The Pacific region was pulled down by the miserable performance of California. The Midwest and South have also done badly. The Middle Atlantic and New England regions, though, were considerably less hard hit. So much for that old Sunbelt-Snowbelt contrast. Finally, there is one interesting case of a job skill mismatch, as the economists like to say. The Financial Times reported on Thursday that the Indian outsourcing firm Cognizant is having a hard time finding engineers in the U.S. The firm's president, Francisco D'Souza, told the paper, "If you look at the core of what we do, the technology work, the U.S. simply doesn't have the talent base today. About 20% of the firm's workforce is based in the U.S., and they find themselves having to import engineers from India and elsewhere because they can't find the workers here. India is pumping out about 600,000 undergraduate engineers a year, compared to our 84,000. A friend who has a Ph.D. in electrical engineering from an elite U.S. university tells me that half his cohort is working outside of the field, mainly in finance and consulting. Himself, he works at a hedge fund. This certainly makes sense for the individuals involved. Science jobs pay a lot less than finance and the hot air industry, consulting, do. But it's terrible social policy, unlikely to produce economic gains over the long term, much less save us from ecological catastrophe. For that, we need engineers, and we're not getting them." And now a special update for the KPFA on podcast audiences only. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released its monthly employment report for August on Friday morning, after the original broadcast of this show in New York on Thursday evening. It was a mildly pleasant surprise, though hardly an unblemished one. Total employment fell by 54,000 last month, though that was pulled down by the disappearance of 114,000 temporary census jobs. At the peak in May, there were almost 600,000 workers hired to conduct the 2010 census. That's heading down towards zero, and we're now about 90% of the way there. Private employment rose by 67,000, and government employment, excluding census workers, fell by 7,000. Those private sector gains were narrowly distributed. Construction rose by 19,000, but half of that gain came from returning strikers in Chicago. Manufacturing fell by 27,000, mostly undoing a 34,000 gain the previous month, but both moves were mostly technical in origin, a result of GM's not making its usual summer layoffs in July, which confused the seasonal adjustment machinery. Private services rose by 67,000, with nearly two-thirds of that coming from health care and social assistance, and another good chunk from leisure and hospitality. Most other sectors showed small changes. In other words, there really are no dynamic sectors leading out of the economic wilderness. Healthcare and bars and restaurants won't do it, and I say this as someone who loves bars and restaurants. In somewhat brighter news, average hourly earnings saw a good gain, but this may be catch-up after several months of flatness. We'll see in the coming months. With the job market as weak as it is, I doubt we're going to see strong wage growth. The numbers I've been citing come from the BLS's survey of 300,000 employers. Their simultaneous survey of 60,000 households appeared brighter in some spots, dimmer in others. Its employment measures all picked up, some of them strongly, but so did its unemployment measures. The unemployment rate ticked up a tenth of a point to 9.6%. Also, the number classified as not in the labor force, because they're not actively looking for work, but nonetheless wanting a job, rose. Most of the rise in household employment came from part-timers, with those working part-time for economic reasons, meaning if they want full-time work but can only find part-time, that rose sharply, almost matching its all-time high set late last year. Nearly a third of those unemployed in July dropped out of the labor force in August. That's about twice the historical average. So while overall employment grew, at this rate of increase, it would take almost 10 years to make up the private sector jobs lost since December 2007, and that's not even allowing for population growth. It's good to see positive numbers, but we've really got to do a lot better than this. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about flipping CDOs. Some of money, success, fame, and glamour. Sounds like it's from a different era, but the first of three songs today's show with money in the title. I have a large collection of those for obvious reasons. Felix the House Cat. We're now joined in the studio by Jesse Eisinger, who is with ProPublica, and he's the co-author, along with Jake Bernstein, of a piece that came out last week on that website, Banks Self-Dealing Supercharged Financial Crisis. And we'll talk to Jesse about that, but first, tell us about what ProPublica is, Jesse.
ProPublica is a nonprofit investigative news organization started about 2.5 years ago now by our founding editor, Paul Steiger, who was the managing editor of the Wall Street Journal for a bunch of years in the time that I was there, actually, and funded by foundations, primarily Herb and Marion Sandler, who started a California mortgage bank.
As I recall, Paul Steiger was much admired by a lot of the traditionalists around the Wall Street Journal, and when Rupert came in, a lot of those folks were on the way out, right?
Yes, exactly. He was a great editor, oversaw a raft of Pulitzer Prizes, and really, you know, was known for the culture of the big leaders in the front page of the journal, the in-depth stories, investigative stuff. And Rupert pounced in the interregnum, in the power vacuum, when Steiger had retired and Peter Kahn, the longtime CEO, had retired, and there was confusion in the ranks at the journal. It was a great time to snap up Dow Jones.
And those long leaders were masterpieces of not merely investigation, but also writing and editing. And I think Rupert found them very tedious, didn't he?
Yes, he thought they were too long, boring, self-indulgent, and they don't really run much anymore.
And I got to say, the new Wall Street Journal isn't as bad as I'd feared, but I do miss those the old front page, which was a daily masterpiece.
Yeah, I feel like it's just not surprising anymore. They do some things pretty well still these days. And in some ways, the financial coverage, the capital markets coverage is better, but I just don't think it's as great a newspaper.
And their New York section is written by people who don't seem to know the city.
I don't read it, so I would have no idea.
No, they actually referred to my neighborhood in Brooklyn the other day as Clinton, forgetting the Hill part. So, I don't know. They drop these people in and think they can cover New York City. Anyway, okay. Oh, just one more thing. So is ProPublica the new model for doing serious journalism in a world where newspapers are disappearing?
You know, it remains to be seen. I think we hope so. We sure as hell hope so. It's, you know, investigative journalism is time-consuming and expensive, so I think that the nonprofit model makes a lot of sense for it.
And you just publish these things on the web, or do they get other distribution as well?
We do both. We mainly partner with other news organizations, so our stuff will run on their newspapers, or we partnered with Planet Money and National Public Radio for this piece, but we've partnered with the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, Times-Picayune, and 60 Minutes. So the main way that we get our big pieces out is partnerships, but we have a website, a vibrant website. I encourage all the listeners to go to it. And it's got a lot of stuff that we just publish on the web.
You also did that piece about the shootings in New Orleans, right?
Yes. A colleague of mine, A.C. Thompson, has broken all that stuff. And it was a big frontline piece. The cops shooting innocent civilians, unarmed civilians, in the wake of Katrina.
All right. Well, okay. Now let's turn to a sleazy business of a different sort. The banks were doing this, essentially taking in each other's washing, right?
Yes.
First of all, I think many of us have either forgotten or never quite understood what a CDO is, and so this is crucial to the rest of the story. What is a CDO?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It's purposefully complicated. A CDO is an amalgamation, a bundling of a bunch of different bonds, and most of these were mortgage bonds. And so you mashed all these bonds up together, and then you sliced them up based on their risk, and you got them rated by the rating agencies. And so there was essentially a top, middle, and bottom, a supposedly riskless piece, a piece that was a little riskier that threw off a little bit more return, and then the very bottom risky piece.
From the point of view of the investors, why not just buy the bonds? Like, why did you need these CDOs?
Well, the idea was, and it of course turned out to be completely false, but the idea was that you were diversifying your risk. So you were getting a big pool of bonds, so you weren't exposed to one specific bond. You had ever increasing exposure so that you would diversify, so you're not just in California or Florida or Las Vegas, but a little bit of all three.
But it turned out that people were buying a pig and a poke, whatever that is, right?
Yes. I mean, what happened was by 2006, investors didn't really want to buy key parts of these bonds. And
were people losing faith in the housing market that early?
Yes. Some people were losing faith in the housing market, and then the other problem was that the returns on CDOs were unattractive because well, in fact, what was happening was the fake demand was masking real demand, and it was driving the good investors out of the market, a kind of Gresham's Law. And in the market came bad investors, these other CDOs, which were buying pieces of CDOs. So you had CDOs buying pieces of CDOs becoming ever-increasingly complicated permutations of bonds.
Now, of course, the CDO can't do anything, so who is doing this buying on behalf of the CDOs?
Well, this is the interesting thing. So the people that select the assets that go into CDOs were called CDO managers. They were supposed to be independent third parties, asset management firms like a mutual fund manager like Fidelity, and they were supposed to pick the assets. But in fact, and our story demonstrates that they were beholden to the banks, that they weren't independent of the banks. They had financial arrangements with the banks, and they were dependent on the banks to give them business, to give them the mandate to manage CDO A and CDO B and CDO C.
So, yeah, some of these bankers were talking like Tony Soprano, right? Like, you know, I'm making an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah, exactly. The line we have in our story, and I hope it's acceptable on the radio, is that you know, Merrill Lynch guy said, "I'm going to make you rich. You just have to be my bitch."
So the banks and these little money management firms had some kind of symbiotic relationship going on.
Exactly.
Yeah, give us some examples of how this exactly worked.
Well, the main way that it worked was that the investment banks would create the architecture for a CDO, and then say to the money management firm, we've created this thing, we've gotten it rated, it's going to have to buy such and such kind of asset, but we'd like you to do that. And for this relatively little amount of work, you're going to make an enormous amount of money. You know, on a $1 billion CDO, you're going to make $1 million a year, and you don't really have to do that much work. So they would get the mandate for the business. And then they had other types of financial arrangements. Essentially, the bank bought the assets before they went into the CDO. Then they would go into the CDO, and the money manager never had to have any money because, you know, money on hand, assets under management, because they would never actually buy the assets. They would just select them officially.
So this masked the fact that there was no real demand, right? There were no outside buyers. This was just flipping things back and forth.
Well, exactly. So what we found was behind the CDOs themselves were the banks. The banks were retaining the top portion, this supposedly safe portion of the CDOs. And every time a new CDO was created, the banks would often take this top portion, which was roughly 80%, AAA rated from the rating agencies. And then each time that they would do this, they would create a new middle part, the 5 to 15% of the CDO that no one wanted. It was unsellable. And they would take that part and put it into a new CDO, and then they would retain the top part of that again. So this is why we call it self-dealing. What they were essentially doing is moving things off their books, but actually buying most of the risk and retaining it, but no one could see it because it was off the balance sheet.
And as all this nonsense was going on, the market was really taking off, right? This is the period of great growth for CDOs, even though there were no real outside buyers.
Exactly.
For
what we found is that the buyers are abandoning the market much earlier than most people realize. So most people understand.
Yeah, I'm surprised it was 2006, because the housing market really didn't start losing air until a year or two later.
Well, the market peaks. The housing market peaks in the middle of 2006, and this is really when the CDO market takes off, and they're going in opposite directions. Housing is starting to go down slowly. There's the first glimmerings of problems in the subprime mortgage market are hitting Wall Street. People are missing their first payments on their mortgage in increasing numbers. Delinquencies start to creep up, real institutional investors start to leave. And this is when the CDO market takes off. So the CDO market more than doubles to $226 billion in 2006 from 2005. And the first few months of 2007, when the market is really falling apart, turn out to be huge months on Wall Street for CDOs and, of course, the attendant bonuses. So bonuses on Wall Street hit a record in 2006 and barely ebbed down in 2007. They're down something like 2%. Monster years, even though the banks start to take billions and billions of losses by the end of 2007.
I speak with Jesse Eisinger, who is a reporter with ProPublica, and you can find him on the web at ProPublica.org. And you can find this story and many other things there as well. You mentioned the rating agencies earlier. What were they doing amidst all this ping-ponging?
Well, they were getting paid by the investment banks, too. They were rating these structures. the CDOs and assigning the AAA rating to roughly 80% of the structure, and then they would rate the other things. But
a lot of that stuff that was rated AAA also went bad, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. The vast majority of the CDOs, that you know, that $226 billion in 06 that I mentioned, those are trading at pennies on the dollar, including the AAA. The AAA ratings were on the AAA-rated security, you should not remotely worry about taking a credit loss. You shouldn't lose a penny. These now are trading at pennies on the dollar. So,
as I believe you say in the story, that the rating agencies were just basically making sure they filled out their forms correctly and not actually looking at the credit behind these securities.
Well, they were modeling the that was when they were assessing these managers. So they got into all these other businesses, the ancillary, very profitable businesses, and one of them was to rate managers, these third-party independent money managers that I was speaking about, and they would rate them on how well they filled out their paperwork without ever assessing how well they actually picked the assets that went into the CDOs. But they were also, their main bread and butter was to rate these structured finance products, these CDOs, and that was an extremely lucrative product for them because it was fancy and complicated, and so their profit margins were huge on that.
And they did a terrible job.
And they did an absolutely terrible job.
And the losses on these arrangements are truly enormous, like scores of billions of dollars for individual banks.
Yes. So the banking system globally took roughly $1 trillion in losses, and over half of that is from CDOs. Merrill Lynch took, on just mortgage-based CDOs alone, roughly $30 billion. Citi took $40 billion. These products alone were the main reason why those two banks and UBS went down.
Now, I imagine there's lots of litigation over this sort of thing now, right?
You know, it's surprising. There is certainly some litigation, but there's not as much as you would think. And the reason why we think that's true, we've come to the conclusion, is that since there was so much self-dealing, since the banks buying it, there are relatively few victims. It's a deep
except the
irony.
Public that paid for
except
their losses.
You and me and everybody, all the listeners, because we're the taxpayers, and we ended up bailing out the banks. Yeah.
And what about the SEC or any of the regulators? Are they doing anything to
the regulators
punish
are,
or enforce?
The regulators are coming in now. They were extremely late to this. They didn't know anything about CDOs in 2007 because these were all private transactions that weren't registered with the SEC. So they're playing catch-up. They are investigating. There are a lot of hurdles to the investigations. You know, they investigated Goldman for a CDO. That got a lot of attention. They fined Goldman $550 million, which is, you know, a lot of money for the SEC, chump change for Goldman. And they've done a select group of other enforcement actions. They're very aggressively looking into it now. You know, the hurdles are that it's complicated. And, you know, for Merrill Lynch, which we focused on in our piece, the bank doesn't exist anymore. It's owned by Bank of America. So it's going to probably be difficult for the SEC to go after the bank itself. Maybe they'll go after individuals.
Well, you know, here we are 4 years after the fact for a lot of these deals, and does it really matter? I mean, the damage is done, the money's been made, and now it's ancient history.
I think it matters because I think we don't understand the crisis, the financial crisis, why we got into it very well. And there's a narrative that says a couple of things. One, that it was a tsunami, that this was a natural disaster, a 100-year flood, something that we couldn't have seen coming, that hit everybody, that we all lost our heads. I don't think that's true at all. I think that people understood there were problems in the market, and they did things about it to mask those problems that actually exacerbated the problem. The other thing is that I think a lot of people blame homeowners for going out and being greedy and buying houses that they couldn't afford, and nobody could get a mortgage on something you can't go walk into a bank and ask for a loan that you can't afford. They have to give you that loan. The bank has to give you that, and the banks did it because they could sell their loans to Wall Street. Wall Street did it because they could securitize those into CDOs that they were actually buying themselves. So a lot of mortgages went to Main Street because of this CDO business on the back end. I think that's poorly understood.
And now, of course, it's nearly impossible to get a mortgage unless you get $1 million in the bank and you have a credit score of 2,000.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that business is dead. But, you know, Has anything else changed in the way Wall Street does its business and the regulators follow what they're doing?
Well, you know, the regulators are always pretty good at fighting the last war when it's this calamitous. So so for right now, the CDO business is dead. The regulations on from Dodd-Frank actually sort of take care of increasing disclosure and preventing some of the behavior that we were talking about in our story. So, you know, obviously Wall Street is going to move on to a new game, and what that is remains to be seen. But what's ironic is that in bailing out the banking system, the Federal Reserve in particular bought a lot of toxic assets. They did it by relying on credit rating agencies and relying on structured finance technology that's very similar to CDOs. So the Fed was essentially eating the cooking that had already gone rotten and created botulism for the financial world.
Well, what a story. And it'd be nice if we learned from history, but I fear we haven't. And I saw there's a headline in the Financial Times the other day, bank profits back to pre-crisis level. So it's happy days are here again. Aren't
and bonuses.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for coming by, Jesse. And thanks for the work that ProPublica is doing, too.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Jesse Eisinger, who is a reporter with ProPublica and co-author, along with Jake Bernstein, who is on vacation, so he couldn't be here. I want to give him credit for doing the
absolutely.
Work, too.
Absolutely.
Bank self-dealing supercharged financial crisis, which you can find on the web at ProPublica.org. Okay, let's take a station break, and we'll be back to talk about the devolution of the American scene with Michael Yates. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at KPFA.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. That was some of For the Love of Money by Defunct, Joe Bowie's band. The second of three songs with money in the title on today's show. We're now joined by Michael Yates, who I believe is in Portland, Oregon these days. Right, Michael?
That's right. How are you doing, Doug?
I'm good. How are you?
You good.
So you retired, what is it now, 7 or so years ago?
And been going on 10.
Oh, my gosh. Time flies, doesn't it? And you've been traveling around this great land of ours and filing reports. You had a piece on your blog, last week, Cheap Motels on a Hot Plate, about this epidemic of passive aggressiveness in the U.S. So tell us about that.
Well, one of the things we've noticed, I mean, we've been on the road, you know, before the housing crisis began and after, and you try to pick out like what's different or what's changed, and sometimes it's really sort of hard to tell because you don't know if maybe you've changed and you're just reflecting on other people what you're feeling. But we've noticed lots of signs of distress, and then try to watch how people respond to it. And, you know, some of the signs of distress that, you know, other people who haven't traveled around the country might not have noticed is you see panhandlers in places you've never seen them before, like in Florence, Oregon, for example, people sitting on the sidewalk panhandling. You see food pantries in upscale towns or long lines at a Goodwill waiting for it to open. People traveling on the cheap, really staying in cheaper motels and hostels. You see old line stores closing. You see short hours in stores. You see public facilities on short hours, dirty streets, roads falling apart. Strangers with tales of woe acting out in public. I've never seen so many people crying on the street in the last few months as I've ever seen in my life, or just yelling and screaming at one another in public. So you see lots of signs of stress, besides the obvious ones, besides shuttered shopping plazas and lots of for sale signs on houses. And then you try to ascertain, well, how are people reacting to it? And I like to describe it as sort of passive-aggressive. That is, you see a lot of passiveness. I mean, unions not doing much, workers being worked a lot harder, as we see from the increases in productivity, but not really doing anything about it. You see homeowners just living with their stress. But on the other hand, what we find is, like, when people are confronted, but when you point certain things out to people, they sometimes react more aggressively than we've noted before. We met an attorney in Boulder, Colorado, and, you know, that's usually rated one of the country's most livable, eco-friendly cities. And usually you see a live and let live attitude, he said, unless you interfere with their needs, quote, then they get sort of ugly and aggressive. So you're crossing the street at a crosswalk. Somebody's in a hurry to get to a meeting. They almost run you over. You raise your hand up, and then it's F you. From them. You see a kid ripping up flowers in the public mall, and you point out to the mother, and she turns on you and attacks, starts screaming at you as if you're to blame. A person blocks your driveway when you're trying to get into your parking garage. You point that out to him. He starts screaming at you. We're renting a place here in Portland from actually somebody we know. They can't sell this place. They're trying to sell it. They've already bought another place. They're stressed for money. We've got a 24-hour notice before a realtor can come in and show the place. And they keep getting calls from the people we rent it from. Can't you let them see it? Can't you let them see it? And I say no, and then they say, that's not right. You understand that kind of thing. A guy damages our car and then turns on us when we insist that he pay for it, so there's just a scratch. That kind of thing that you see.
That sort of behavior.
We've seen it like over and over again, more than we saw it in the past. That's sort of what I get.
This sort of behavior is often symptomatic of depression, these sort of explosive rages and things. Is that the mood that underlies
it? I think there's some of that. That is, people don't know where to turn. Like, of course, you know, they're easy enough to blame the homeless. There's increased attacks on homeless, usually by young people, physical attacks, or they're quick to jump on the anti-immigrant bandwagon. You know, I've heard a lot of tales about that over the years, or turn on minorities or Muslims. And in that sense, you know, nothing's much changed in the last 100 years in the United States, has it? I mean, you've pointed that out before. Everybody thinks we're on the verge of fascism, but the same kind of things happened in the 1930s, except then we had, like, some more public movements, social movements that you could turn to for relief or to vent your anger or to get something done that might improve your circumstances. Now those things don't appear to be available. And so people behave like that, I think, probably because they turn inward on themselves, the anger and hostility that they're feeling. And if you get in their way, in any way, even in a subtle way or a non-confrontational way, you don't want to confront people these days. I mean, that could be dangerous if they misbehave.
Well, as a retired economist, I'm sure you talk to people about their understanding of what's going on with the political economic environment. What do you hear when you
query
them?
You don't hear too much except everything's corrupt. If you start saying everything's corrupt, well, people jump right on that. The government's corrupt. Everything's a scam. I mean, you see cities and towns raising money by, you know, the police have a lot of money. And, you know, they set up these things where they get people for drunk driving, and then that becomes like a big racket of money raising. So if you tell somebody about something like that, they say, yeah, I can understand that, or this politician's corrupt, or that's corrupt, or nothing works right. And people jump right on that. But as to the causes of these things happening, well, it's sort of like a populism, like we've always talked about in the past. It's not anything where they could grasp the whole system's at fault. Or if they do say, well, that's capitalism, but they don't see that anything could possibly be done about it. And they know that they can't really turn to the government. I mean, in all the, you know, we go around and you look for signs of, like, well, what has the government done to alleviate the circumstances? And you see those America Recovery Act signs, you know, on the highways, you know, they're doing work. That's about the only visible sign you see where the government is actually trying to do something to alleviate misery. Now, I'm not saying the government hasn't done anything. You know, they've shifted a lot of money to the banks, and they've shifted money to the states, and they've got unemployment compensation extended, and that's helped people out, no question. But even with respect to that highway construction, we were on this long road in Montana. A couple of economists actually mentioned this. I was reading. I can't remember their names now. But you see a lot of construction equipment, but we drove like 50 miles, didn't see a worker. Nobody. The road's closed, and there's barrels up, but nobody's working. You see, that doesn't require that much labor to do this. So, you know, whereas in the 30s, you might see, like, people out working to restore the public parks or to build dams or engage in public works projects. You don't see that. So when people look at the government, they don't see overt signs of the government trying to help the masses of people. So it's easy enough to turn on the government and say, well, they're just helping the bankers and blah, blah, blah. But you don't see much real understanding of things. Doesn't seem to me. And I usually don't like to press my point of view on people and say, well, don't you see this or don't you see that? I just let them talk and see what they say about things. I might mention something every now and then if the person seems sympathetic, but they're not always. Because like you always say, I mean, there's a lot of sympathy for, like, the common sense right-wing or sort of conservative ideas in the United States. It's not a very progressive country when you come right down to it.
Yeah, speaking with Michael Yates, retired economist and writer, who's been traveling around the country for the last decade and acquiring lots of interesting observations. And as you were speaking, there was an ad on the TV in the studio for a political campaign about the swamp of corruption in Albany. So that's the vocabulary that everyone has. It's just corruption.
No, I agree. Sure, it's corruption, and you know the rich people on Wall Street are corrupt, and you know that they're going to do you in. But instead of, like, doing anything about it, I'm not saying nothing's being done. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there are, like, the healthcare workers on the West Coast and the immigration struggles, but they don't amount to a hill of beans in terms of really challenging the power of those that have it. And so that suggests to me there's not really much understanding or grasp of what's going on. I mean, other kind of things that we've seen, I don't know if it's a result of depression or stress or what, but, I mean, this is one unfit nation physically. I mean, New York City, that got to be one of the most physically fit places in the country. Out here in the heartland or out here in the West, I mean, this is America the fat. This is America the unfit. I mean, I don't say that meanly, but, you know, I was in the town of Ely, Nevada. That's a mining town, and, of course, that's another thing we've noticed, this incredible environmental destruction, which seems to only be getting worse. There was a big increase in demand for coal and copper and gold. And there's gold mining everywhere, and there's copper mining everywhere, and it just rips up the countryside, and, you know, and a lot of logging, too.
It leaves a lot of toxic residue behind as well.
Yeah, it leaves, oh, my gosh, and then rips up the land, too. It just creates these big, horrible, ugly scars. So anyway, in this town of Ely, which is a copper mining town, it was dead in the water a few years ago, but now there's some prosperity, though you wouldn't notice to look at it. And I'm in this hotel. It's a casino hotel in Nevada, and I get in the elevator every day, and every day I'm getting on the elevator with people that weigh 500 pounds. I'm not 200, not 250, not 300, but about 500 pounds. Men and women just, guts hanging out. I was in Richfield, Utah, at a Walmart there. Richfield's not an unprosperous town. It's a farming town. And, it's a Mormon country. First of all, there's a whole wall of survival goods for sale in the Walmart. You know, like 20-pound boxes of powdered margarine, you know, for when the end times come.
What are people expecting? Apocalypse?
Well, I guess, I talked to one fellow who I know there, actually, and he says everybody's out taking target practice because they're waiting for the hordes to come up to Highway 15. So the hordes of brown-skinned people from Los Angeles
that are
apparently going to come and take their property. But anyway, the people in the store, I mean to tell you this, first of all, there's so many people in wheelchairs, and there's those little scamp things, you know, they're motorized. You've seen them in stores or on the sidewalk avenue, people riding in these little motorized carts, like,
oh, yeah.
They're not wheelchairs, really, but they're electric, like on that Seinfeld episode,
right,
where George gets this electronic cart because he claims he has a disability. And they're just everywhere in these places, and the people on them are like 300 or 400 pounds. In Portland, Oregon, which, you know,
it's supposed to be a hotbed of healthy outdoorsmen.
But it's not. I mean, well, first of all, I guess it's from the rain, so I shouldn't criticize. But their pallor, I mean, talk about alabaster skin. There's an old hymn we used to sing when I was in the choir in grade school, and one of the verses was, "Death's pallid hue comes o'er thee, the glow of life decays." And that's what I think of when I see these people. They're smoking. They got this pallor in their skin. I've never seen this. Is sort of scamp central here. You have these people on these motorized carts, 300-400 pounds. Sometimes they have oxygen tanks and they're smoking cigarettes at the same time. Now, those might be extremes, and I will admit that they probably are.
Well, no, the OECD put out
there's not a lot of fitness here, and of course that makes people down and depressed. And there's so much cheap food in the United States, and people are just gobbling it up, you know, all this corn syrup and things like that. And
the OECD put out a compendium of social indicators last year showing the U.S. to have about the worst in the Northern Hemisphere. Shortest life expectancy, worst mental health record, most obesity, most systemic chronic diseases. Yet we consider ourselves, we boast of being the healthiest people in the world. The only people who outdo us are the New Zealanders. We have this just grossly inflated sense of our health and wealth and well-being.
Did you ever think maybe that's like a function of like American imperialism or something, that it's just like the fact that we don't think much about the rest of the world, and America is the most powerful country? I mean, sometimes I think I'm really living in a nation of decline in decline. This is the first time I've really sort of felt like that in my life, like the outward signs seem to indicate that something fundamental is changing here. I'm not sure that's so, and I don't like to make predictions, so I don't know if it's so. Maybe in 10 years there'll be these big booms and all kinds of prosperity. I don't know. It doesn't feel like that right now. But Americans cling to this notion that this is some super country, God's country, the best country in the world. And so maybe that's why Americans, even though they are unhealthy, even though a lot of people are unhappy, even though a lot of people are sort of passive aggressive from what I can see anyway, yet they still cling to these delusions. And maybe it has something to do with that. I don't know.
Well, you've been in a couple of places that have reputations for being kind of enlightened and vigorous and healthy and liberal, like Boulder and Portland. What is the reality of living in cities like that?
Well, there's some truth to it. People in Boulder are pretty fit. They really are, but beneath the surface of things, first of all, there's a lot of air pollution in Boulder. A lot more than you would think, and there's a lot of pollution in Portland, a lot more than you would think. Wages are not so hot in either place. In Boulder, brown-skinned people do all of the dirty work, but you never see them. There's a ton of entrepreneurs in Boulder, but a lot of them come from the outside. There's a whole lot of English people and South African people and Australian and people from Australia that are rich. A lot of them are into this eco-friendly making of money. Like the guy that has that electric car company, Musk is his name. He has an operation in Boulder, and his brother lives in Boulder, and they claim to be eco-friendly. They have this eco-friendly restaurant the brother does, which caused us no end of problem because they had the smoke coming into our apartment all the time. So there's a lot of people like that give the place a reputation as sort of liberally enlightened, but underneath the surface of things, like the people that are fit, for example, don't get in their way on the weekends when you're hiking because they got their stopwatches out, and they don't want you to be in their way when they're trying to make their rounds. And if you say hello to them, they don't answer back because they have to get to where they're going in a certain amount of time. So there's a lot of that, and then there's tremendous resentment from the old line Boulder people about the new people. So if you read the Boulder paper, they allow you to make comments. So there'd be an article about somebody, and Jesus, the venom. You can't believe it. I mean, they look up people's records and they say, "Yeah, that guy did this, but he was a crook. He was no good." And so underneath the surface, there's a lot of anger in places like that. And I find the same thing in Portland. It's still a tremendously white city. There's not much diversity here.
Well, it's a hotbed of the
good features. It's a livable city. Don't get me wrong. It's a walkable city. It's a livable city. The rents are pretty high, I think, higher than they should be. And there's a music scene, an art scene, and that kind of stuff. There's a good movie scene. So there are a lot of good features. There's a lot of good restaurants to eat at if you eat out in restaurants, more than there were the last time we lived here. But Maybe I complain about every place, Doug. Maybe I'm not a happy person.
I do get the sense, though, of just social decay. That when we talk about a country in decline, that's what I feel.
I'm glad to hear that, because sometimes Karen and I feel like we're just like crazy or something. Like we keep seeing these signs, and you hear people talking. And sometimes, you know, you listen to people's stories, and it saddens you, because you see like people are up against these. These pressures. I mean, I talked to a cleaning woman at a hotel in Albuquerque, and she has to clean 27 rooms a day. That's unbelievable. In Las Vegas, where they have a union, the standard is 15. So you hear her story and you see her face, and you, oh my gosh, you just think, oh my, how do you live? How do you survive? And you know, you see a lot of circumstances like that, or even people that are a little bit better off, and you know, they got two mortgages they're carrying, they can't. We rented from a guy in Tucson who was really nice, nice fellow. We rented a house from him, and he was been an airline pilot. He lost half of his pension in the collapse of the airline industry a few years ago, and he's retired. And he really liked this place in Tucson. He loved Tucson. He bought this place. It was a nice little place where we stayed, but he had a house in Illinois that he couldn't sell. And he rented the place in Tucson to us. He'd only lived in it for 2 months or 3 months, and he rented it to us and had to go back to Chicago to try to sell this place there, where 40% of the houses in the housing development he lived in were for sale. And you could tell the stress must be enormous. You know, just these stresses build up, and where are they going to go? They have to be turned inward if you don't have any way to turn them outward. And if you turn them outward, well, then you look for the And if there's not progressive movements, you look for scapegoats and you find them.
Yeah,
and the immigrants that are being harassed and attacked all over the place.
We got to get in here a little early for the candidate statements, but I do want to, in the last couple of minutes, ask you about. It seems to me that most Americans have this very individualistic, monadic sense of their problems, and they don't really think politically, socially, systemically at all. So, how do they understand the situation they're in?
Well, I think a lot of people turn it inward and think they made bad decisions. They made mistakes. Like if you were to talk to that fellow from Tucson that we rented the house from, he would say probably, if you pushed him, he paid too much for the house. He made the mistake of not realizing the housing market was going to collapse, and now he's stuck and it's his fault. And he has to find a way out of it. So I think people still look like that. It's unbelievable, really, when people found that people did that during the Great Depression of the 30s, and they're still doing it 80 years later, looking inward or looking for easy solutions. Now, I don't overrate Doug. I mean, I think Glenn Beck's a crackpot. I think he has more following than some people probably think, but you know what I mean. It's like that's run-of-the-mill stuff in the United States. But some people are attracted to that kind of thinking. I just think that's they see their situation as either their own fault or some scapegoat's fault. That's sort of how they see it. It's quite remarkable when you think about it.
From your description, it makes New York sound almost like we're at relative peace with each other and ourselves.
We've been thinking a lot about New York here tonight, actually, and you know, you start to think it's a pretty good place in a lot of ways. I mean, I think probably people are. I'm not talking about the really poor people, but I mean the average person is probably happier there than the people that we've been running out into in the so-called heartland. I mean, if you go to some of these little towns like we've been in California and Nevada, I don't think people are happy there at all. They don't seem to be anyway. I mean, they're ugly for one thing. These towns are all ugly. There's a development here in Portland called the Pearl District, which is really nice. They did a good job of rebuilding these warehouses and building new apartments, and it feels like a little city there. But that's one of the exceptions in terms of like aesthetics. Pretty places. Most of these towns are just eyesores, horrible. I like to be out in nature, and that's where I try to find, that's where I try to find enjoyment, being in beautiful places. But then, you know, you see these tree blights and all this stuff, so even the beautiful places are changing. All the glaciers are disappearing in Glacier National Park, and the trees are all dead in Rocky Mountain National Park, and that's kind of depressing to me. But But in these little towns and villages and mid-sized towns, with some exceptions, you know, they're ugly, unhappy places. So I think probably you're lucky to be in New York City, to be honest with you.
All right, we got to bring it to an end
there. I wouldn't leave if I was.
No, I'm not planning to. But to quote Wallace Stevens, the world is ugly and the people are sad. We got to end it there. That's it. I've been speaking with Michael Yates, who is a retired economist and blog Cheap Motels and Hot Plate. Check it out. Very interesting observations on the state of politics and culture and the economy of the United States. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'm not sure when exactly. Bye. Let's go out with this from Killing Joke.